Welcome to the Oxford Sidebar Podcast for June 2013 from the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association. Our speaker this month was Dr. Lewis Dartnell, who spoke to us about astrobiology and the hunt for alien life. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to tonight's Sidebar. It's a great pleasure for us to introduce tonight's speaker, Lewis Dartnell. And before we get going, I should say who we are. We're the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association, and we run monthly sidebars here at the Port Mahon. You'll see some flyers around for our coming up sidebars. We've got one next week, and we normally have one every month, but this month we actually have two. But anyway, it's a privilege to introduce to you tonight our speaker, Lewis Dartnell. And Lewis actually did his undergrad in biology in Oxford. From there, he went on to UCL and did a PhD in astrobiology. And now he's a UK Space Agency research fellow at the University of Leicester. And if that's not good enough, during that time, he's also written a couple of books. He's appeared on Horizons, I think Wonders of the Universe, written a load of articles for places like The Guardian and New Scientist. So he's done a lot. And I also saw you did a talk in Royal Albert Hall. So that's quite cool as well. Thank you for joining us. And tonight he's going to talk about astrobiology and the hunt for alien life.
Good evening. Thank you all very much for coming along. I do feel like I'm performing in the round in the corner of the pub here. So my name is Lewis, or Dr. Dartnell. I finished my PhD about 7 years ago now at UCL. And after doing biological sciences here at Oxford, just over the road, in fact, in Queens, I was in the Florey building just on Iffley Road for my first year. It was a brutal, brutal building. But after leaving here, moving on from my undergraduate degree, I found an incredible department that had recently been founded at UCL, University College London, called COMPLEX, which is the Centre of Mathematics and Physics and Life Sciences and Experimental Biology, which is a massive mouthful of an acronym, a very impressive acronym for a department. But it really kind of wraps up, I think, quite nicely the way that science is now going and everything being very interdisciplinary. And so there's myself as a biologist joining this new department, and for the first year of Masters, you start with an MRes, they will shove a group of you, of biologists and computer programmers and mathematicians and physicists, and they pretty much just shove you all into the same room and say, there you go, teach each other stuff that you don't know yet. So I learned a whole lot of computer programming and physics simulations and things like that in the first year. And then after that Masters, they quite literally give you a suitcase full of cash and say, this is your PhD research funding. Go take it. Go spend that on whatever you like. Go choose your own supervisors. Go write your own PhD, propose your own PhD title, and do something as long as it's on the interface of biology and something else, which is how I got involved in astrobiology, which I suspect is still a little bit on the fringe side of things, talking about the hunt for aliens. But the meat of what I do and the title of my PhD thesis, which is written in gold lettering down the spine and looks ever so impressive, at least I think so, and the title of the thesis is The Subsurface Cosmic Ionizing Radiation Environment on Mars, which again, being a scientist, is full of lots of big, long, Latin-y words to make us feel very impressive. But the nubbin of what that thesis was about, what my research since has been looking into, is the Martian death rays. Now, these death rays aren't being wielded by the tripods if the Martians ever come to try and invade the Earth. The death rays on Mars are what would be killing off any native Martian life. So if there ever was a genesis of biology on Mars, if life ever developed its own life, and they're there, still on the surface of this dusty red world now, those Martians, those microbes, will be bombarded from outer space, from above their heads, by some very, very nasty radiation known as cosmic rays, the cosmic radiation. And this is everything from particles spat out by the sun during a massive flare, during something like a coronal mass ejection, or galactic cosmic rays, which are accelerated by supernovae and exploding stars throughout the galaxy. So as soon as you get beyond the atmosphere and the magnetic field of the Earth, you're bathed in this very nasty radiation field, which is a big concern for trying to send humans to Mars, to try to send astronauts to the moon and to Mars. And it's also a very big concern for Martians because they're basically naked to this radiation on the surface of Mars. So I've been doing a bunch of computer simulations of modelling what the radiation on Mars is like, and meters underground, because this very energetic radiation can penetrate through meters and meters of solid rock. And if we do want to try and protect our astronauts from this radiation, it's not going to be as simple as putting a bit of lead lining in their spacesuits to shield them from that radiation, because it can punch through meters of rock. It'll go straight through anything you can put in the way in a spacesuit. And you trigger really kind of a nasty shotgun effect, where the radiation creates more radiation particles when it hits stuff. So you end up making things worse for your astronauts, not better. It's a very complicated situation. It's a very complicated situation, and then trying to understand how to keep our astronauts from not dying in space of horrible acute radiation poisoning. And if one of these solar flares, the kind of things I was modelling for Mars, if one of those things had gone off during the Apollo era, when three men at a time were basically the size of a caravan with very thin aluminium shielding like this on their space capsule, and they'd hit one of these flares, you would have received a lethal dose. It would have been fatal, with no question. And what we mean by fatal dose in radiation is that you would have died 3 or 4 days later, with all of the cells lining your intestine would have been killed off by that high radiation dose. So you basically vomit and diarrhea yourself to death over the course of 3 days in something the size of a caravan with two other guys similarly dying in a very unpleasant way. All in zero gravity, floating around with all of this euphemistically described as mess. So radiation in space is a big deal, not just for looking for Martians, but also for us, for sending people out there. So I do a lot of radiation modelling, but also as a biologist, so that's the kind of computer programming and particle physics side of stuff that I do. But as I've mentioned, I've come from a biological background. I like to get my hands wet and dirty doing real experiments with real cells. And I work with some bugs and bacteria from one of the most Mars-like places on Earth, which is down in Antarctica, down by the South Pole, in a region known as the Dry Valleys, or the McMurdo Dry Valleys environment. And this is one of the coldest, driest places anywhere on Earth. There's no animal life and no plant life whatsoever that can survive there. It's just bacterial. And so I've been culturing bacteria from this place that they've got the right kind of survival skills to survive on Mars, and growing them up nice and healthily in the lab, and then blasting them with high doses of gamma rays to try to get them to die again, because then you know what their radiation resistance is like, and you can compare that biological information with all the computer modeling you've done about what the radiation environment on Mars is like, and therefore how deep underground we'd want to be able to dig to find stuff on Mars that might still be alive today. And this is very, very important, because one of the missions that I'm working on directly at University of Leicester, but previously at UCL as well, is a new rover, a new probe called ExoMars that's being designed and built by ESA, by the European Space Agency. And NASA's not getting a look in on this probe. They basically last year decided they'd run out of pocket money and then had to withdraw from this big space mission. So it's Europe going it alone with Russia to build this life detection rover called ExoMars that we're going to launch to Mars in 2018, specifically to look for signs of life. And for the first time ever, what we're doing with ExoMars, what we're sending, the piece of kit we're sending this rover with, is a drill. Because up to this point, all we've basically done is kind of scooped around with a robotic arm on the windblown dust on the surface of Mars, which is totally sterilized. There's clearly nothing in the dust on Mars. Or Curiosity, which is the current NASA rover. It's a massive jeep-sized rover with a nuclear power plant and a high-powered laser for shooting at rocks. But it's basically got a drill the length of your little finger. And it kind of pokes its pinky into these rocks to see what's under the surface. But with ExoMars, we're going with a drill 2 meters long. So we're going to be able to get a good arm's length underground and grab some of that Martian soil and bring it back up to the surface to test and analyze and stuff that's been protected and shielded from this radiation up until now and look for signs of life in that Martian soil. And one of the instruments that's flying on ExoMars to look for organic molecules, to look for signs of life, or so-called biosignatures, is known as a Raman spectrometer. And that's the instrument that I'm working on in Leicester. It's basically a two-for-one instrument that tells you what kind of rock you're looking at, but also what kind of molecules or organisms might be inside that rock. Oh, by the way, if you want to ask anything as I ramble on, please do. I'm monologuing and have no idea how long this bit might take. But if I say anything that is of interest to you, please shout out or shove up a hand. Yeah.
What you're talking about seems to be predicated on life, which is like ours. Is life that's not like ours excluded or too difficult to model? Or?
So the question then is why we look for life that's like ours. And it's a good question. And if you're doing astrobiology and trying to look for life on other planets and life, therefore, by definition, will be different from us or alien to us, you don't want to be too blinkered, I guess. I guess you want to think out of the box and look at what alternatives to our biochemistry there might be. But also, on the other hand, I think you want to not waste your money and your time and effort by sending rovers to Mars or to Europa or other places in the solar system. So I think, at least while we're still young in this field and we're only first starting to look, it makes a lot of sense, I think, to go with something that we know works. And we know that water-based life or carbon-based life or DNA-based life, protein-based life like us, we know it works because we're here. So I think it makes sense to look for that kind of organism. But even more practically, pragmatically, we know how to look for that kind of life because we do it when we go to Antarctica or the Atacama Desert, or you know, you look for bacteria in your own blood system and kind of medical research. We're good at finding sequences of DNA and amplifying them up and sequencing them. So it's for that reason that we're mostly right now searching for familiar life, because we could have a shot at finding it. But I think you're absolutely right. The most interesting discovery on Mars would be firstly finding life there at all. But even better than finding life that's similar to us, I think we'd be finding life that's very, very different. If you find life on Mars that isn't DNA-based or uses some different compound for its membrane or something other than proteins as the kind of molecular machinery inside its cell to power it and drive it. Because if we find life that's different from us, we get a kind of another example of how biology might work, and we can compare and contrast ourselves against alien life and I think learn a lot in that process. So that is why we look for stuff that we know how to recognise. If we look beyond Mars to the outer solar system and Jupiter, which is basically the big daddy of our solar system, it's a massive bloated gas giant planet, and it's not Jupiter itself that we care about for the chances of life. It doesn't really have a surface, doesn't have oceans or lakes of water for life to get started in. And it's actually the moons of Jupiter that we care about for astrobiology. And one moon in particular called Europa. Europa on the surface, we can see, is frozen hard. It's hard frozen water. And we can see lots of cracks and a few, but not many, impact craters on the surface of Europa. So we think it's a dynamic world, that it's kind of freshening its surface and eroding and filling in the impact craters, and for the same reason Earth doesn't have many impact craters on its surface. And back in the late 1990s, when we were exploring Europa with one of the probes we sent out there called Galileo, we discovered something very, very quirky, which is the magnetic field of Jupiter kind of drapes itself around Europa, which tells us there's something conducting on the surface of that ice. And then the best way to interpret that, the best way to explain that, is there is a salty ocean beneath the face of Europa. And when you calculate it, when you model it, it turns out that the ocean, this kind of dark alien ocean in the innards of this moon Europa, will have more liquid water in it than all of the seas and lakes and rivers and oceans of the whole of the Earth put together. So it would be Europa, be this tiny moon orbiting this gas giant, turbulent, cloudy world in the outer solar system. It's Europa that's the water world of our solar system and not the Earth. And so again, we're very, very keen as astrobiologists, as explorers, to get out to Europa and try to explore it in person, or at least with our machinery, with our robots. Europa is very difficult to explore, though. It's far away. But the moon orbits in what's basically the Van Allen belts of Jupiter. So surrounding the Earth is a donut shape of trapped radiation particles, which are an issue if you're sending astronauts through that to go to the moon. And one of the arguments is put forward by the people that claim it's conspiracy, that deny we ever went to the moon, that the moon hoaxes, the lunar hoaxes. One of the arguments that the moon hoaxes put forward is that humanity, people, wouldn't be able to go through this radiation belt circling the Earth, which is obviously bollocks. But it's not bollocks for the Van Allen belt surrounding Jupiter, because it's much, much more intense magnetic field, much more intense radiation belt surrounding it. And you would be dead within minutes if you were to find yourself in a spacesuit orbiting Jupiter. And that's where Europa sits in its orbit around the planet. And so sending probes to Europa, they also have a very big... they also find it very hazardous to be working in this radiation environment and nuking their computers or nuking their electronics. But for life in the moon, this radiation belt might actually turn out to be the saving grace. Because if you're sealed in an ocean with this great big thick ceiling of ice on top, and this is at least several kilometres thick, and maybe tens of kilometres thick, this thick shell of ice around this dark moon, the ocean, this dark moon, where the sunlight can't get in, you're kind of constrained as to what kind of energy can be flown through the ocean, and what kind of energy might be able to fuel or feed a biosphere or an ecosystem on. But what we find in some incredible examples of life deep in the crust of our own planet is life that is basically indirectly living off radiation energy. And in rocks with things like uranium and thorium, so radioactive elements in them, the radiation is given off, smacks into molecules of water, splits them to give you kind of oxygen and hydrogen, which then dissolves in the water that's in these deep, deep rocks. And the bacteria will then munch the oxygen and hydrogen, kind of recombine them, and fuel themselves by eating this radiolytically, this radiation-produced hydrogen. So the cells on Earth, there's life on Earth, which basically would not care if the sun were to blink out tomorrow, because they'd be quite happily munching their way through this radiation-produced energy. And that's what we think would also be possible in this deep, dark ocean in Europa, that it'd be radiation-fueled in the biosphere, with all this Van Allen belt radiation powering down on the surface of Europa. Yeah.
Just quickly going back to what you said about Mars, you know, about the radiation, you know, how that might be an obstacle to life. How does the level of radiation, say, on the surface of Mars compared to what some microorganisms on Earth can withstand? I mean, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's a bacterium, or at least one, or something...
Deinococcus radiogerans.
Yeah. Which can take quite a lot, can't it?
It can take an awful lot. So that's what's growing on my lab bench. That's one of the organisms I work with. It's one of my favourites. And this is... So this Deinococcus radiogerans, it means something like terrible balls radiation survival, or something like that when you translate the classics, the Latin, the Greek. And this bug, this bacterium, grows on your Petri dish with this lovely, lurid, kind of bright pink colour. And it also happens to be one of the most, in fact, the most radiation-resistant organism known on the planet. And you can, and I have, grow this thing up, grow this cell up, and hit it with radiation doses thousands of times higher, what would kill your eye. And this bacterium basically shrugs its shoulders, waits a little bit, repairs its DNA. So the reason that radiation is damaging, both for us and for bacteria, is it mostly shatters apart your genome, your DNA. As this cell realizes that its DNA has just been shattered by having been exposed lots of radiation, waits for a bit, and then repairs that jigsaw puzzle, puts its DNA all back together again, and then gets on with the rest of its life. So things like Deinococcus can survive incredibly high radiation doses, but only if they're able to repair it, if they're metabolically active, or if they're warm and wet with kind of nutrients around. And the problem with the surface of Mars is that it's so cold and so dry that anything right on the surface, and therefore exposed to radiation, and therefore also stuff we'd be able to reach for the foreseeable future, is going to be desiccated or frozen, and therefore not metabolically active. So that the way I describe it is these cells, if they are there, would be like kind of sleeping beauties, and then they'd be slumbering as this damage accumulates and they get killed off in their sleep. And that's why it's a concern to see how much the radiation accumulates over time.
Could you maybe genetically modify humans in the future to be able to repair their own DNA?
Yeah, I mean, that's the comic book story kind of thing, isn't it? And researchers are looking into Deinococcus to work out what makes it so radiation resistant, and then start trying to apply that maybe to cancer or human cells, or developing drugs that can then recreate that in a cell. There's a guy right at the back.
Okay, could you give us a ballpark idea of how much rock or ice or whatever would it take to protect a human or a bacterium? Were we talking 1 metre, 10 metre, hundreds of metres down, roughly?
It depends. It's quite complicated. And it depends on things like what period of the solar cycle you're in and what kind of material you've got above you. And something like ice turned out to be a very, very good radiation shield because it has lots of hydrogen in it, which is good at absorbing the radiation. So one of the proposals for protecting astronauts on a flight to Mars is to have a kind of a storm shelter, so a small part of the capsule that you rush to if the space weather report tells you there's radiation coming, and you surround that small cupboard-sized thing where you hide for a day with all of your water tanks.
Sure, but could you give us a ballpark number? So, I realise it will vary with many things, but so 1 metre, 10
It's of the order of 2 to 3 metres.
2 to 3 metres.
So the Earth's atmosphere, and I'm going to use a unit here, the Earth's atmosphere is just over 1,000 grams per centimetre squared of shielding depth. Obviously, it's very, very low density. So if you start using the density of rock, you get to 2 or 3 metres of rock will give you the same, basically the same amount of stuff above you as the Earth's atmosphere. Because you can basically ignore Martian atmosphere because it's so thin. So a couple of metres depth and then you're basically shielded. But you can only get 2 metres down with ExoMars, if that, because we don't even know if it's going to go to the full depth when it's sampling.
So very close to the...
Yeah. But also we're probably also talking hundreds of millions, if not billions of years, that stuff will have been frozen and preserved and dormant. So it's a very long time to accumulate all that radiation. Yes, mate?
I was just wondering if there's an optimum level of radiation, if it's, you know, playing some role in driving mutations through evolution, and whether you'd expect in a subterranean ecosystem that things evolve more quickly towards the surface and more slowly as you go further down. I don't know whether you'd be able to explore that with your drill, but if it's only second order in terms of what, if it's mainly thermal things and other things, noise sources that cause mutations.
Well, there's also variation in the amount of radiation exposure to organisms on the Earth. And being up high, you get less shielding. Or if you're surrounded by lots of granite rock, which has more of these radioactive elements, and you get a greater dose. And there's a lab that's just been opened up by another UK astrobiologist called Charles Kakel. And this is in the Bowlby mine on the East Coast. And the company there is wanting to drill out all the potash, which they can then sell for lots of money. But they basically got a hole that now goes 3 kilometres down into the crust and is therefore perfectly shielded from radiation from cosmic rays and from the radioactivity of the rock. And the question they want to answer is exactly that. If you have no radiation in your background, how does that change how cells work? Might they mutate in a different way or evolve or adapt to the low radiation environment? I suspect that although you do induce mutations from radiation, which is basically the raw matter for evolution, obviously, there's enough other processes going on in the cell that also give you mutations. So I don't think it will be the case if you happen to be in a perfect radiation-free environment that you evolve more slowly or something, because you're mutating yourself the whole time just with your metabolism and releasing reactive oxygen species and things like this. So possibly not. But it is very interesting, and people are trying to look into that.
When we're speaking about Mars, presumably it's about retained life, because in these hostile conditions we hardly believe that it used to be flourishing many years ago and now it is dying or hiding somewhere. Yeah. But besides radiation, it's a very hostile temperature conditions. The question is the following: do we have any information regarding what is the temperature profile when you go down to the Mars? Soil. The temperature in 100 meters below the surface and so on. It's interesting because without appropriate temperature, life cannot survive even without any radiation.
Yes, those are all true things. And the surface of Mars is very, very cold. So cold that all the water is frozen hard and you don't get to use it to grow. But if you go deeper into the Martian crust, into the innards, the interior of the planet, it gets hotter and gets warmer, just the same way as it does if you go down to the Earth. And in the Earth, probably the thing that defines how deep life can penetrate, how deep life can survive, is not the pressure, but the temperature you reach, and you start going above 120, which no life on Earth can survive, that we know. And on Mars, because it's a smaller planet which has cooled down more quickly, you can get deeper before you start reaching sterilising temperatures. So it's thought that perhaps several kilometres down, you've got the frozen surface above you, the warm innards of the planet, and then this habitable zone deep underground on Mars where there's still some water that's ice that's then frozen into kind of films of liquid water in cracks and crevices in the rock that life could survive in. So on the surface, life's either extinct or having a really rough time of things and cryopreserved and frozen solid. But deep down, there is still the chance that on Mars there might be an active ecosystem, active biosphere in the units. And one of the biosignatures for deep life on Earth that we might expect to find on Mars as well is methane being given off. A lot of these very deep forms of life are what are known as methanogens or methane-releasing bacteria. And lo and behold, a couple of years ago, we found plumes of methane gas seeping out the Martian surface in exactly the way we would expect were there to be deep life respiring in the kind of warmer, wetter regions and seeping out. So there's a lot of excitement about that, because that's basically what we were looking for. But it kicked off a massive, massive argument and big debate, and it's very contentious as to whether we have actually discovered methane on Mars or not. Because you either use a big telescope on Earth and looking through all of the methane in our atmosphere to Mars, and then somehow subtract away Earth's methane and be sure that you've done that properly, or you have a really meany, weeny little instrument that you launch on a space probe over to Mars, and it's not very effective at then measuring things. So that's the two different papers that people have tried to look for methane on Mars, and then the jury is still out. But that's the kind of signature that we would be looking for. Yeah.
The bacteria that can repair themselves after radiation, do we have any idea that suggests, I guess, another template other than DNA that isn't destroyed by radiation? Do we know?
Radiation isn't picky or choosy.
Sure.
And DNA is damaged because it's a big polymer, a big macromolecule. So any information storage molecule that you've got, whether it's DNA or anything else, would be knackered, would be hit hard by radiation passing through your cell. So in the research I've been doing and what other people have been doing, you basically have to make your best guess. And so we say, well, life on Mars, reasonable to assume it might be quite like ours. It might in fact be the same as ours if there's been transference of life between the two planets.
So I thought you said the bacteria that you work on repairs itself after it's been...
Yeah.
So how does it repair itself? What's that mechanism, I guess?
So what people were hoping for when they first started studying Deinococcus radiodurans to work out how it repaired this radiation, what they're hoping for is it might have a whole different repair system, a whole different mechanism for repairing that. You could basically then cut and paste, you could copy that and transfer those set of genes into another organism and go, da-da, there you go, you have the radiation resistance now. But curiously, it hasn't got anything that we don't have or any other cell doesn't have. It's got the same repair mechanisms, but it uses them more effectively. It kind of upregulates them. And it also has some other quirks of its cellular biology. And Deinococcus has many different copies of its DNA, its genome. It's got many different genomes. So it's almost as if it's got multiple redundancy in information. If one bit gets knackered by the radiation, it can look to one of the other spare copies and then copy that across perfectly and not induce mistakes that way. But in a molecular sense, yeah. So as with when human cells repair their damage, so you have to detect the damage has occurred with particular proteins interacting with each other in these great complicated signaling pathways. And that's all Deinococcus is doing, but just a bit better than us. Without getting into too much of the boring nitty-gritty of it, what probably is the most important thing for Deinococcus is it can stop the radiation happening in the first place. And it has very low iron levels in its cell, but very high manganese instead. And through quirks of the radiation chemistry, you don't want iron floating around your cell if you're being hit with radiation, because then the iron goes off and starts attacking everything else. So it prevents a lot of the damage happening. Also, if there's no other questions, we can move, if you fancy, move beyond the solar system, because there's been an awful lot of research in the last 15 years discovering planets orbiting other stars in the night sky, the so-called extrasolar planets or exoplanets. And although the first ones of these, so the first was discovered back in 1996, and since then, the tally, I think, is almost up to 900 now. 900 new worlds orbiting other stars, other twinkling stars in the night sky, other suns in our galaxy. And the first of these we discovered were all very, very big planets, like kind of four, five, six times bigger than Jupiter, and all orbited very, very closely to their sun as well. So they're called hot Jupiters, and there was no chance of liquid water or organic chemistry in worlds like that. But it's a selective bias. It turns out that it's easier to spot fat planets close to their star than small, rocky planets further from the star, like the Earth is, and therefore planets which would have the conditions for liquid water on the surface. And this is where the concept of the habitable zone comes across. You want a planet that's not too close to its star and hot, but not too far away and cold, but in the middle, just right, in this kind of Goldilocks zone where the temperatures are right. And we've not discovered an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone just yet, but we've come pretty close. And there was a paper in Nature about a month or two ago of a super-Earth, so something slightly bigger than our planet, about, I think it was almost twice the diameter, so a fairly small rocky planet, we think, snugly within the habitable zone of its star. So this may well be one of the first almost twins of our planets we discovered in the night sky. And there's ongoing surveys and ongoing missions and space telescopes trying to spot these planets orbiting other stars. And once we've got this short list, this shopping list, if you like, of the closest Earth-like planets to the closest Earth-like planets to us, the next step we want to do is build an even bigger, more expensive space telescope that then looks at that planet you know is there, teases away the incredibly faint light that's kind of scattering through that planet's air, through that planet's atmosphere, and throw away the much, much brighter light coming from its sun. And then you do spectroscopy on that planet's light. And so you basically make a rainbow with that planet's light. And you can look for the fingerprint of different compounds, different gases in its atmosphere. You can read the chemistry of a planet's air from light years and light years away. And the signature, the biosignature we'd be looking for, and this would get people very, very excited, would be a mixture of both oxygen and methane in the planet's atmosphere. Because the only way we know how to explain that would be because life pumped them there. The only reason we're breathing oxygen right now is because life basically polluted the planet about 2.5 billion years ago with oxygen as a waste product from photosynthesis. So if we find an oxygen-rich atmosphere, we would conclude with a pretty good degree of certainty there was life on that planet, which would be exciting. I think, though, that might possibly be the most, or one of the most frustrating discoveries as well. Because not only would we know there's a planet out there, you'd be able to go out and, you know, into your back garden on a nice clear dark night and point to a particular star in the night sky and say, there's a planet orbiting that star. You know for a fact it's got life on it. We can see the oxygen in its air. But it'd be centuries and centuries before we could do anything about that. The distance between the stars is so great. But even if we knew
How far away?
So the Kepler Space Telescope is peering back along the spiral arm of our galaxy and has detected something like 1,500 planetary candidates. But most of those in that kind of cone of space it's looking through are hundreds of light years, if not a few thousand light years away, which is still basically still our neighbourhood in terms of the galaxy as a whole. But it would take us, I think the fastest we reckon we could ever build a spaceship to go at would be a few percent of the speed of light, using the technology we understand and not things like warp drive and wormholes. So if you're trying to go at a few percent the speed of light, something that's hundreds of light years away, you know, you're talking tens of thousands of years, even to send a probe there, let alone try and bring any samples back or kind of explore it close up. So what we're really keeping our fingers crossed for is a luckily close planet that has oxygen in its atmosphere, because we would then be able to do all the spectroscopy on it and potentially send a probe in a few hundred years, only a few hundred years. Yeah.
Much closer to home, it's an old prediction, of course, that an atmosphere out of chemical equilibrium might well be a sign of life. We have Titan with an atmosphere that has far too much methane in, and yet people have been very wary of saying that might be due to life. Where's the speculation on Titan at the moment? Because naively, you would say that methane is implausible. Unless life was making.
Yeah. Did anyone hear that? Do you want me to repeat the question? Yes. So the stuff I was just talking about, of looking for oxygen and methane in an Earth-like planet's atmosphere to infer that it has life in it, the science you're basically doing is looking for an atmosphere out of chemical equilibrium. It's an unbalanced chemical system, because the oxygen and methane should react with each other very, very quickly and disappear. So if you see something with both of them in the atmosphere at the same time, you know there must be a process constantly producing them. And there's another example in our own solar system of an atmosphere that's out of chemical equilibrium with what we'd expect, and that's Titan, which is a giant moon orbiting Saturn, and Titan's even bigger than the planet Mercury, so it's a big place. And it's the only moon to have an atmosphere in our solar system. And the atmosphere in Titan has got quite a lot of methane in it, which again shouldn't be there. It should be reacting and being removed. So there might be some geological process or some dynamic planetary process that's releasing the methane, or perhaps life itself or other compounds in the Titanic atmosphere we think might be bioindicators. Because the wet stuff we find on the surface of Titan, we see rivers and lakes and rain clouds on Titan, and they don't rain liquid water because it's far too cold. They rain methane. So the methane perhaps wouldn't be a sign of life on Titan. It'd be the wet stuff the Titanic life would need to grow in, their kind of analogue of water. There'd be methane-based life rather than water-based life.
Yes, and yet it's difficult to explain how the methane, you know, what can the source be, what can keep making it, since it must break down into more stable compounds, presumably.
Yes, exactly that. I'm not a planetary geochemist, so that's about as much as I understand about it. The methane is curious, but you don't necessarily attribute it to life. You need to kind of rule out other possibilities first. Anyone got any questions?
What would the methane react with?
So the methane is chemically is quite a reduced compound, and so it would react with anything oxidised and go down to carbon dioxide. And so the very fact that we see methane, or think we found methane in the Martian atmosphere, is curious, because the methane should have been oxidised. It should go back to the carbon dioxide that we do see. It would react back down to CO2. So it would react with oxidants or oxygen, or just be destroyed by sunlight, by ultraviolet light of the sun. So Titan is further away from the sun, and the flux is much, much lower, but you're still talking about very long timescales. So the methane on Titan would be being destroyed. The fact that it's still there, so the fact that we still see that there is methane must mean there's something releasing it to replace what's been removed. Yeah?
Can I ask about panspermia, as I think it's called? About the idea maybe that life forms in space.
Sorry, that life forms in space and then is transferred even between stars. Any comments?
Yes, so that is the theory of panspermia. And I think the important thing about panspermia, which basically means seeds everywhere, it's the idea that life can be transferred, can hop from planet to planet. Kind of two different varieties, two different flavours of panspermia. One's not job crazy, one seems to actually be pretty likely. And the not job crazy flavour is the idea that you can have life delivered to planets inside a comet. And you might have, either you have life kind of get started in the comet itself and then delivered to a fertile young planet like the Earth with warm oceans once it's formed. Or maybe you can have life from a different star system travel through interstellar space, which we've just been talking about, it's a very, very long way, and somehow get incorporated into a comet as a solar system forms, and for that comet to then deliver that life to a sterile planet and inoculate it or seed it with life of its own. The other variety that seems to be actually pretty plausible is you don't transfer life between different star systems, but it seems pretty likely that we could transport life between neighbouring planets in the same solar system. So from Earth to Mars, Mars to Earth, maybe a long time ago before Venus became the kind of hellish hothouse, the greenhouse planet that it is now. And there's a good chance that Venus had oceans on its surface a long time ago. So maybe Venusian life got started and then was transferred to Earth inside meteorites, because you can splash off bits of planets' surfaces, bits of rock, by very large asteroid impacts. And the idea is that in the early solar system, during this era known as the late heavy bombardment, which is basically where the craters on the moon have come from, during this late heavy bombardment, it's almost as if the inner planets of our solar system are constantly sneezing in each other's faces by having great big splashes of rock splayed off, flying through space, landing back down on another planet, maybe getting splashed back off again. So perhaps we wouldn't even expect for Earth and Mars and Venus to have been separate from each other. Perhaps in a way we should consider them the same system, because they've had ample opportunity to exchange material. And so one of the possibilities we're hinting at a bit earlier is if we do find life on Mars, and we find actually it's carbon-based, it's water-based, it uses proteins, it uses DNA, it's actually pretty similar to us, if not even suspiciously similar to us. And in fact, maybe it is the same thing. Maybe we're deeply related and we're transferred from one planet to the other. And the kind of punchline of that story would be that we are all Martians already, that the life on Earth got started on Mars and transferred here inside a meteorite. And it's one of those glorious hypotheses you could never prove either way. Because even if we find life on Mars, we don't know where we started from and where we got transferred to later. So that's the idea of panspermia. And if we did come from elsewhere, if Earth was seeded from elsewhere, we would have come from locally. We would have come from our own neighbourhood, from the solar system, and not from a planet orbiting another star. No more questions?
So I was wondering how important the size of a planet,
So the question was does size matter?
In terms of
planets.
That's right.
And we think it does. And if you have a very big planet, as the solar system forms, you have enough gravity to track lots of gas out of the solar nebula and build up a very, very thick atmosphere and basically turn into a Jupiter or a Saturn. And they are rubbish for life. So you just cross out gas giants. So if we're talking about rocky planets like Venus or Earth or Mars, the question is, when we're looking for life on other planets and orbiting other stars, how close to the size of the Earth do we think this gives it the best chance? So something like Mars, which is about half the size of the Earth, is probably on the too small side, because it's got weaker gravity, it's lost a lot of its atmosphere, it's been blown away into outer space, it's got less heat inside it, so all of its volcanoes have now died, which means it's no longer topping up its atmosphere every time a volcano erupts. It's lost its magnetic field, which we know it once did have, which is also produced by the kind of churning heat in the interior of the planet. And all of those things probably prerequisites for life to develop and evolve for long periods of time, and certainly to create complex life, like animals and humans. So Mars is probably too small. So on the other side...
But do you think that depends on the size of the star that that planet orbits around? Because I guess with a bigger star, the distance between the star and the planet kind of affects the gravity on that planet.
So the question then was, how is that affected by the star, or the star that you orbit, the size of the star? And those are kind of two different questions. It matters what kind of star you orbit, because stars are different sizes and hotnesses, different luminosities. They shine with different amounts of energy. But for pretty much any star, there'll be a range of distances from that star, from the heat of the campfire, where liquid water would be possible on a planet. And that's the habitable zone, or the Goldilocks zone. So firstly, you want to find a planet in the habitable zone. Otherwise, it's boiling hot or freezing cold, like Mars is. But aside from that, aside from the star, the particular thing is about the planet, as to whether the planet is too big or too small to maintain the conditions necessary for life for long periods of time. And so a planet can be too small, like Mars, and lose its atmosphere. Or if it's too big, we think things like plate tectonics start breaking down, don't happen. And we think that plate tectonics is crucial for regulating our environment and keeping the climate nice and stable over very long periods of time. So for the best chance of life, you want to have a planet orbiting the star at the right distance, but also the right kind of planet, and the right kind of chemistry going on its surface.
So how many planets in the universe, I don't know, in the kind of radius that we're looking at from the Earth in the hope that we could find some sort of life? And of all those, which one do you think is the most promising?
So we now know, because of the Kepler Space Telescope, we now know that in our Milky Way galaxy, where there are about 400 billion stars, are even more planets. There are more planets in our galaxy than there are stars. So on average, every star has at least one planet. Probably like our solar system, will be stars with very diverse families of planets orbiting, so kind of 9-10 planets around that number. But I think your question was more how many of those planets might be habitable. Is that what?
How many planets that we have looked at in our whole?
How many planets have we checked to see if there's life on?
Yeah.
None, not a single one yet. So, planets in our solar system we can go to with probes, as we're doing at the moment. Planets orbiting other stars, we didn't know of a single planet on another star before 1996. And in terms of the scale of science, that's ludicrously recent. And up until that point, people thought that the solar system itself might be unique. There might have been some quirky event that created the planets orbiting our sun, and Earth might be unique, and there isn't any other planets in our galaxy, and therefore life would be unique as well. And it's only since then, since 1996, we now know there are other solar systems. But it's the next step after that, once you've found these planets, is to then check them for life. And we have been able to do the spectroscopy technique on a number of different planets orbiting other stars, but not the kind of planet you'd expect to find life on. We've looked at the big, hot ones, because they're easiest to observe. And when we do start finding, hopefully, the small, rocky, Earth-like planets in the habitable zone of their star will then do that same technique. So we've got kind of proof of concept, proof of principle, but we haven't found the right candidates yet to start looking at with our telescopes to look for oxygen in their atmosphere. So that's the kind of thing we're waiting for next.
You were earlier talking about methane-based life. Do we know anything about it? Is that even possible?
So the question then was about methane-based life and how possible it might be. We don't really know. And methane is a very different kind of solvent to water. It's a non-polar solvent, whereas water is a polar solvent, and therefore is very good at dissolving kind of ions and large molecules like DNA. So it's a very versatile wet stuff to dissolve things into. And in particular with methane, it being non-polar, something as fundamental as the membrane around your cell, it would basically have to be turned inside out. You'd have to have a fundamentally different kind of membrane to be able to live in liquid methane rather than liquid water. And in order to be liquid, methane has to be very, very cold, which means all of your chemical reactions go exceedingly slowly. So maybe that might be a hurdle to stop life developing in the methane lakes and seas on Titan. It's too cold, the wrong kind of solvent. But again, we don't know. And you can't start talking too much, I don't think, about our own situation, about terrestrial life, because we've got data set of n equals one. We've only got one example to base all of these kind of arguments on. And it might just be that Earth life is very well suited to water because that's the kind of planet that we evolved on, because that was the wet stuff on Earth when life got started. And maybe methane would be perfectly adequate for Titanic life. It just finds different solutions to the same problems than what we found with water. There is a student, a PhD student at UCL, who was in the planetary centre with me before I moved up to Leicester, a girl called Lucy. And she's been looking into exactly that question: what kind of chemistry can you get going on in liquid methane as a solvent rather than liquid water? It's quite difficult because methane gets explosive if it stops being liquid and starts evaporating. So she's had some technical problems. No explosive technical problems just yet, thankfully. But I mean, it's the kind of point that we don't really know much about the chemistry of methane because no one's been bothered to check before, because it hasn't really had any applications. It's not really used industrially, so no one's put the money into looking. So it's very much a wide open field of research.
Yes, do you think it's strange that you're talking about the habitable zone and at the same time you're talking about worlds that can support life subsurface due to their internal heat, which could be literally anywhere in space?
Yeah, so the question, if you didn't hear it on the other side of the room, is if we're talking about habitable zones and this region of distances around a star where it's warm enough for liquid water on the surface of the planet, but in another breath, I'm talking about water deep beneath the surface of moons like Europa. And we've probably been a bit too close-minded up until now, considering only Earth-like planets in the habitable zone. But again, obviously, we know that works, so it makes sense to look for that kind of planet and that kind of life, because Earth is alive. And we don't know if there's life in Europa yet. But looking at our own solar system, there is only one small rocky planet in the Goldilocks zone, Earth. But there are two, if not three, moons that have got water beneath their surface and therefore a habitable environment. So in the galaxy as a whole, Earth might be the freak, being a warm, wet planet in the habitable zone. And actually most life in our galaxy might be in these kind of deep subsurface, dark oceans, in the innards of moons, of gas giant icy moons. And again, we don't really know until we start going to Europa and exploring it and somehow trying to get a probe to drill through kilometres and kilometres of hard frozen ice, or sample the surface. But even that is pretty difficult. We're not going to be doing for 15, 20 years in the future, sampling the surface of Europa. One of the moons I've not mentioned yet is a moon of Saturn called Enceladus, which is a tiny little snowball of water. No one paid any attention at all. No one cared about Enceladus until just a year or two ago, when Cassini, which is one of our probes, we launched out to Saturn to explore the rings and the storm systems and the moons of Saturn. And it found, coming out of this tiny little ice world, plumes of water, with the fountains of Enceladus. And once they discovered these fountains on Enceladus, we wanted to know where they'd come from and what's in them, what they're made of. And so they piloted Cassini to kind of swoop low over the surface of this moon and plunge its way through these fountains of water jetting out into the cold depths of space. And they basically got the probe to kind of hang out its tongue and use all its instruments and a quick couple of minutes of flight to analyze that water. And the water in those fountains of Enceladus tasted salty. There were sodium ions in them. And again, the best way to explain that is that it's not the kind of ice being blasted off by gas escaping, but there's a subsurface sea of liquid water that's salty because it's in contact with the rocks underneath, and therefore got dissolved nutrients in it. So perhaps even Enceladus, that no one cared about just 2 years ago, would have a habitable environment with an energy source and liquid water and nutrients in it. And the brilliant thing about Enceladus is that it basically samples itself for you. It's vomiting its own innards into outer space. And all you need to do is build a probe to fly from Earth out to Saturn, swoop through those fountains with kind of panels, collection panels splayed out, grab some of that water from space, pull it back in to kind of protect it for the return flight, and then parachute land it on Earth and look for organic molecules or signs of life in this deeper water that would come out of Enceladus. And so a lot of people, for that reason, a lot of astrobiologists are saying that perhaps we should ignore Mars and ignore Europa and go straight to Enceladus for our next mission. Because although it's a smaller moon, it's much easier to sample and get some good answers from. Yeah.
Given, say, today's technology and unlimited resources, where would you, what's our best chance of finding it, finding life, say, within our average lifetime, I guess? I don't know. Where would you look and what would you do?
So I'm kind of hedging my bets at the moment because I'm focusing on Mars, because we have already got missions confirmed and funded for Mars. So it makes sense to bet your career on that one for the moment. My hunch, however, is that we won't find life on our own solar system before we find it very, very far away. Because with these space telescopes, you can sample thousands, if not millions and millions, of star systems and planets nearby. If only a few of them, these Earth-like planets locked in the atmosphere, we'd spot them quite readily. And the Earth has been conspicuously alive for about 2 billion years itself for the same reason. So I think we'll likely find the conspicuous evidence of life. Thank you very much. Conspicuous evidence of life on an Earth-like planet orbiting another star, even very, very far away, before we find life right on our doorstep, because it's going to be difficult to find. It'll be underground or long dead on Mars, and you're looking for heavily degraded molecules or organics on the surface of Mars, or drilling through 10 kilometres of solid ice on Europa to get to the ocean. And it might be an alien Earth that we find the first signs of life on. But then you get that real frustration of knowing that it's there, but being able to bugger all about it. Yeah.
I know it's not quite your field, but could you touch briefly on the idea of someday humans living on Mars?
I do that kind of thing. I speculate on that kind of stuff for money. It's something TV companies love to hear about. I don't know if you heard, there was a proposal, optimistically or kindly. There was a proposal called Mars One to send humans on a one-way mission to Mars to set up a base, set up a colony, and they would be contestants. It'd be like a Big Brother type setup. And the idea, you laugh, the idea was that people would enter this competition and be selected to go to Mars on a one-way mission to live there and never come back. And people signed up for this. People were putting their name and details into the website to be considered, which I think speaks volumes about their own psychology, about why they want to leave Earth forever.
We have done with Magellan's voyage and Copernicus' voyage. I mean, most of the people died.
Yes, yeah, so people take risks. And at the moment, I think we're probably being a bit too risk-averse. There's no reason we've not been back to the moon since mid-70s. We were technologically able. If we'd kept up momentum, we could have then gone on to Mars and have sent the first human mission there. And yes, it's risky, and yes, it's dangerous, but people are willing to take those risks, and we can try and minimise them. And I think it's disappointing that we've not sent a human mission to Mars. If you're talking about sending humans to live there permanently, the idea of a one-way mission actually probably isn't all that crazy at all, because it's much, much easier to send a one-way mission than a return mission. It's much, much easier than twice as easy. And the idea would be, it's kind of analogous to the colonists leaving Ireland or leaving England to sail across the Atlantic to go to America on a one-way mission, never expecting to come back to the homeland, but to make a life for themselves in the New World and to farm there and build up a homestead and have children and generations of people where they've gone to. And this would be the same philosophy that people are talking about for Mars, just a bit further away. Being very difficult to grow stuff on Mars without all the kind of technology needed for basic life support. But the concept, I think, is a good one. And once you're committed and have got people alive on Mars, you'll not want for them to die. So you've got that incentive to go back with further missions and build up more infrastructure and send more habitats or more equipment and kind of build up a colony and basically pull yourself up from your bootstraps. That's the idea behind these one-way missions. Mars One, I'm certain, will never launch. It's basically flawed when it comes to the financial model and the kind of technology they're trying to talk about. But I suspect it's probably not too far from how we actually will start colonising Mars, using that kind of model. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could give a brief summary of how life starts, or our kind of life starts. How it would start on another planet, how it starts on ours, our understanding of how it starts.
A lot of these questions I'm going to have to say I don't know to. And it isn't known. What we do know is that what we previously thought probably is wrong. And people used to talk about what was known as the Urey-Miller experiment. And you can make some basic chemistry apparatus and glassware and have some water with some basic compounds like ammonia or carbon monoxide dissolved in. And you zap lightning bolts, sparks across the air in this. And if you do this for a week or two, you get this really thick, viscous organic sludge at the bottom of your experiment, and that's absolutely jam-packed with amino acids and organic molecules that have been created from scratch and the building blocks of life. However, when you rerun that Urey-Miller experiment using what we now know to be the chemistry of Earth's early atmosphere, we've got a much better idea, you basically get squat at the end of it. It doesn't work with a less reducing atmosphere. So no one really talks anymore about Darwin's little pond or primordial soup, or life on the surface and lightning bolts. And what seems to be the most probable contender, the most satisfying answer or scenario for life getting started on Earth was not on the surface and sunlit, but dark and deep and around one of these hydrothermal vents that we find on the sea floor. And not actually the black smokers you might have heard about, because they're far too hot. But there's another whole category of hydrothermal vents that, again, we only discovered about 20 years ago, which are alkaline vents. And they're about 70 degrees. They're basically the ideal temperature for running organic chemistry. And they're alkaline. And the gradient in acidity, and therefore protons, from the inside of this hydrothermal alkaline vent to the cold outer seawater is exactly what you get across every single one of your cells. At a very fundamental level, all life on Earth is powered by a proton gradient. And you get that same proton gradient in these alkaline hydrothermal vents. So it's almost like we've kind of bubbled off that little bit of hydrothermal vent and carry around with each of our cells today, running that same basic energy generation process. If you want to read more about this, a guy I work with at UCL called Nick Lane, I built for him a hydrothermal vent on the lab bench, which we couldn't quite get to work until my funding ran out 4 months later. But they've got a PhD working on it now. He's written a very, very good book that won the Royal Society Book Prize the year before last, called Life Ascending. And it's genuinely one of the best popular science books I remember reading. And it's all about the kind of hurdles that life has to pass to go from boring bacteria up to kind of photosynthesis and plants and advanced life that's multicellular, to kind of animals and intelligence. And chapter one of that book is the beginning, is how do you get life started in the first place. And he talks about his own research and others on these hydrothermal vents.
What's the guy's name?
Nick Lane.
The last chapter is about death.
Yeah. It's very good.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Details of our upcoming events can be found at our website, www.oxfordsidebar.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @OxfordSidebar and on Facebook, British Science Association, Oxfordshire Branch.